Okay, colleagues, members of the public, I'm going to call to order this April 8th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. We have a lot of bills to deal with today, both in public hearings and work session. But for those of you who are here for Senate Bill 598 or Senate Bill 809, those are the two apprenticeship bills, we are still in the amendment stage for those. So we're going to be coming back to them next week. We're going to start out with Senate Bill 845. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 845. On Monday, we had a brief hearing. As many of you know, the Senate was engaged on the floor throughout almost the entire time that we would have met. But there were some people here who came specifically, took time off from work to testify. So we had a 15-minute meeting that day in order to let them testify. But now we're actually opening up the bill, and this is a chance to present it to you. And I'm actually going to go down and join you, Senator.
That's why he's here. Okay. Does that mean you're... Sorry, I thought you're... You go first. I'll go second.
Okay.
I thought you were just leaving the room. Oh, okay. Well, it's good to know. Why don't you just go ahead?
I hate this bill so much.
No, yeah, go ahead. Do your normal thing, Matt.
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 845 imposes a penalty by the Oregon Employment Department on large employers whose employees receive health insurance coverage through medical exchange program. It appropriates penalties to the Oregon Health Authority for certain purposes and provides a remedy for employees subject to retaliation for applying for or receiving medical assistance or premium tax cuts. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, Madam Chair, committee members. This is a bill, yes, I'm Senator Michael Dembro, former chair of this committee. I represent District 23, which is northeast and southeast Portland. This is a version of a bill that I brought to the legislature 2 years ago, and I think I brought it to a committee that Senator Knope was on. And it had to do with the problem, the concern that as we are in a post-Affordable Care Act age, where employers are eventually, and I think it's beginning this year or next year, going to be required to take on some responsibility for the health care, the health insurance of their employees. Need to cover the employees who are working 30 hours or more. And there was a concern at that time, and to a large extent that concern is playing itself out, that employers were going to move people below the threshold in which they would be eligible for those benefits by reducing their hours and turning full-time positions into part-time positions. And this was a concern that was expressed at the time. I was at that time particularly focused on this phenomenon within the world of higher education and adjunct part-time faculty. We were afraid that their hours were going to be lowered in order to keep them out of benefits. And in fact, we've seen a number of reports that have indicated that this is actually happening. And But we also had a concern, a related concern, that had to do with employers essentially shifting their employees onto public assistance and to where the state or the federal government would have to pick up the expense of their health care, even though they were, employees of companies that arguably could afford to provide those benefits. So that bill looked both at the specific problem related to adjunct faculty in higher education and employees in general. We have another bill that is addressing the issue of higher education that's going to be heard in the education department, in the education committee. And then for this committee, we have Senate Bill 845. With that, I'll turn it over to my good Senate colleague and answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from Northwest Portland and Beaverton, and also a family physician. And I'm honored to be sitting here with Senator Denbrough talking about this important bill. I come at this from two perspectives. The first, as a physician, I'd been hearing about this anecdotally from patients where they said they had had health insurance through their employer and then their hours had been cut to be just below the threshold and that this was happening. And I sort of said, well, isolated incident here or there. But there have been a series of surveys, too, as recently as last month, by reputable national organizations, including the Society for Health Resource Human Resource Managers, that show that this is happening across the country, both in states that have expanded their Medicaid population under the Affordable Care Act and in states that have not. The problem arises, and this is where I come at it from a separate perspective. I, like many of you, believe that most people want to be self-sufficient. They don't want to be dependent on the government for safety net services, and that the government should be striving to minimize the number of people in our society who need safety net services. And when people have their hours cut to put them below the threshold where they would have to be provided health insurance under the ACA by a large employer, the chances are pretty good that they will also become eligible for a range of other state services, including SNAP benefits, potentially housing assistance, et cetera, et cetera. It puts them more at risk for homelessness or home insecurity, for other kinds of food insecurity. It traumatizes their children because there's a concern that they don't have enough food to eat and makes it harder for them to learn. And the long-term ramifications in terms of our school graduation rate, in terms of the number of adult Oregonians who are dependent on safety net services from the government grows exponentially, which is not a goal I think any of us aspires to. And I personally am a little troubled by the idea that the state should be subsidizing large businesses by paying these benefits for workers just because they've had their hours cut. And I can understand that there are some industries where part-time is really the only way to do it because there's issues of split shifts or whatever. But in a lot of industries, if you're going to have three part-time workers to take the place of two full-time workers so that nobody meets the three-quarter time threshold, that's problematic, and I think we could all agree with that. Yes, more people are working, but it contributes to what we call the U-plus rate, which is the unemployment plus underemployment rate in the state, which is much higher than it should be, and it does contribute more to people needing state services. So ultimately, I think we need to hold large businesses accountable for paying their fair share and for not depending on the state to indirectly, covertly, essentially subsidize their businesses by paying for these benefits for their workers. And that's really my strong interest in this bill. This bill, as you'll hear later from others, sets up a mechanism whereby large employers would contribute to a trust fund that would help support health insurance through the exchange for these workers, and it would make it so that there's a more level playing field, that large employers who are doing the right thing and not cutting workers' hours won't be penalized, essentially, for doing the right thing, while large employers who do this will end up benefiting from subsidies from the indirect subsidies from the state, which I find somewhat problematic as a use of taxpayer dollars. So that's part of my approach to this. Everybody should have affordable health insurance. We are still in an employment-based system. All employers who should be providing health insurance should carry their fair share of this benefit. Thank you. Happy to take any questions.
I will just add, Madam Chair, that you'll be hearing from the Employment Department of how we will, approach the question of who would be included in this, and you'll be hearing others who can speak to the details of the bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Great.
So who next to come up?
Mr. Chair,
He's good.
Okay, I'm going to call up Graham Traynor and David Gerstenfeld, please. Could the two of you come up? And colleagues, before they begin, we did, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, have a brief session of public testimony where some workers came and spoke to their experience of why this they supported this bill. Graham, you want to?
Sure. Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, thanks for the time and for your persistent effort to have a public hearing on this bill in light of Monday's schedule. My name is Graham Traynor, and I'm today representing the Oregon AFL-CIO, the statewide Federation of Labor Unions, and an advocate for all workers in the legislative process. And I'm here to give some context on Senate Bill 845, what we're calling the Oregon Healthcare Accountability Act, and talk a bit about what we believe is really a simple solution to a very real problem in our state. I would encourage you to look at OLIS. You may have already seen the testimony that was uploaded from Monday, where we had three working Oregonians give their perspective from both the private and the public sector. And I think that it really speaks to the problem that the state is facing in this, as the senator mentioned, in a post-ACA world. Just like in the last legislative session, and as you've already heard, our objective bringing forward this Oregon Healthcare Accountability Act isn't rooted in interest in opening up a debate about the Affordable Care Act. However, our interest does come from serious concerns about trends in this post-ACA world of large employers reducing hours to avoid the employer mandate penalties and to avoid providing health care for their own workers. SB 845 also takes into consideration feedback from the public hearing on a similar bill in 2014, which I've gone back and watched many times, about challenges and concerns related to that approach, and specifically the burden of proof with pinpointing the reduction in workforce hours being solely due to the Affordable Care Act. A recent report shows, and you've got information in a packet that I uploaded to had uploaded to OLIS as well, that nearly 200,000 Oregonians right now are receiving public assistance, that were receiving public assistance in January 2014 worked that previous year. These are workers trying to do the right thing, but still being forced to rely on public assistance programs, specifically related to health care, to make ends meet. There's a significant cost to taxpayers when employers don't pay living wages or provide adequate health benefits to the tune of $1.7 billion annually. The trend of taxpayers subsidizing low-wage, no-benefit employers is concerning for many reasons, and the state, we believe, can actually do something about it. As a state, if we do nothing about these types of trends, we are effectively saying that we support having taxpayers foot the bill for employers that don't provide adequate, accessible health care to their low-wage workers. This bill provides a solution to, again, a very real problem. For those that believe in that the legislature should do everything in its power to reduce the number of Oregonians on medical assistance programs, allowing the state to save and reallocate those scarce resources, this bill actually presents a solution, one that might not fix the entire problem, but it's one that creates a disincentive for employers to keep their workers making poverty wages with no access to employer-provided health care. I'm going to just give a brief overview of Senate Bill 845 and an amendment that we're also working on. SB 845 instead simply defines large employers, very in line with the Affordable Care Act's definition of a large employer. It requires that the Employment Department coordinates with OHA, the Oregon Health Authority, to determine which large employers have actual workers on medical assistance programs, and it creates, from our perspective, a simple formula to determine a penalty assessed on those large employers with workers on these programs. Additionally, I mentioned the amendment that we're working on. Additionally, there are a few changes we know that we'll need to make. We understand that the bill isn't perfect as it's currently written, and after conversations with both the Employment Department and others, we're currently in the process of requesting an amendment to incorporate a lot of that feedback. I wanted to just raise some information about the types of employers we're really talking about here. You've got a reference to a couple different studies in your OLIS packet that I uploaded, and so I'll just talk a little bit about that. We intentionally exempted public employers due to mainly fiscal considerations, but as you'll see in the testimony that was provided to you on Monday, that's not to say that this trend isn't in the public, doesn't happen or isn't seen in the public sector as well. With the definition of large employer at 50 or more employees, it's my understanding, and others that may have better information about this may correct me, but it's my understanding that we're only talking about approximately 4 to 5% of Oregon businesses to begin with. Additionally, a recent survey of over 700 human resource professionals, which again is uploaded in your OLIS packet, referenced that the large majority of employers are doing the right thing. We believe that and are not reducing hours in response to the Affordable Care Act. However, according to the survey, approximately 20% of all employers surveyed had either already reduced hours or has plans to do so for part-time workers in response to the Affordable Care Act employer mandate. So you would have heard on Monday from workers about their personal story. You'll hear from a worker a bit later today about their stories related to healthcare and the challenges that they and their coworkers face. I would like to highlight for the committee that the stories that you would have heard and you've seen in OLIS from Monday and the story that you'll hear from a worker today are from workers that actually have representation on the job and work under a collective bargaining agreement. And if these are the challenges that are faced by workers with that voice on the job, I'd like you to imagine what it's like for a low-wage worker, again, without representation or a voice on the job. We urge your strong support for SB 845 to ensure that the state is moving away from the trend of subsidizing large employers. And again, this is a new era. This is this post-ACA world is new, but as Senator Dembro pointed out earlier, this is a trend that really is bearing out. And there are sorry if it was too long, I think there's 24 pages of my packet that I uploaded, but I did want to make sure that I captured a number of the news articles that have been written talking about this very specific trend that we're attempting to address with a solution. I will conclude my remarks there. Thanks for the opportunity to testify and for hearing the bill today, Senator.
Thank you very much, Graham. David, welcome back. Tell us how the Employment Department would interact with this process.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, and members of the committee. For the record, David Gerstenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Employment Department. And in terms of the operational piece, the Employment Department does have the role under this bill of assessing civil penalties against large employers whose employees are receiving some sort of medical assistance. And wanted to thank Graham and your office for working with us so that we could talk through what the implications would be. Some of my comments will be about the bill as drafted, but also referencing some of the anticipated changes through the amendment. Some of the kind of practical issues that we looked at were which employers would be covered, and there are some technical changes that I anticipate seeing in the amendment just about the definition of employer to make it a little bit easier for us to administer and to avoid a situation where one employee could essentially be counted for two different employers in some circumstances, and also matching up a state definition about related controlled groups of corporations to the federal IRS definition. And those are really things just to make it a lot easier for us to administer so there weren't multiple definitions. At a very high level, the way that this would work for the Employment Department is we have information from the quarterly filings that employers make about how many people work for employers. So we have the ability to identify who the large employers were. We will work with the Oregon Health Authority and get information from them about which of those large employers have how many employees are receiving medical assistance. There's a formula that's going to get a technical adjustment, I believe, but it's a pretty straightforward math equation for us then of you have X number of employees working for you that are receiving medical assistance. We multiply that by the cost of a silver level health plan, some information that the Department of Consumer and Business Services would provide us, and we then assess a penalty against the large employers based on those factors. That money would go into a fund that can be used for a number of purposes regarding providing health care services in Oregon and also to pay for the administration of the program. So a couple of the things that we've worked on in terms of the implementation details. One relates to that funding. It looks likely that after the program is fully in swing that there would be enough from the penalties to pay for the full administration costs and also for the other purposes about providing health care. One of our concerns as an agency was having to start the program and start assessing the penalties before there are any penalties in the fund to pay us to do that. So we do want to flag that as something to make sure that there's some ability for us to do that work ahead of time before the fund has any money in it. One of the things that we talked about was how to ease the implementation of this, both for the businesses in Oregon and for us administering it, so that there wasn't a flood of new work. And one of the things that we've talked about that I think there will be some version of in the amendment is kind of phasing this in over time, so that the first year it does not immediately apply to all businesses who have over 50 employees. We would start out with a higher threshold. That would give some time for education efforts for businesses and for us to get any issues that have to be ironed out done so when it's a much smaller number of businesses. To give a few numbers, it looks like right now there's about 5,300 employers that have over 50 employees in Oregon. So that's kind of the ultimate endpoint definition of large employer. If we looked at scaling it in, starting out with just businesses that had over 500 employers, then we're looking at a much smaller pool of businesses that would be impacted. That's about 375 right now. And then there are ways to stair-step that in. That's out of about 114,000 businesses total in the state. We have looked at what it would take to get the program implemented from our perspective. We think that the data exchange with the Oregon Health Authority and to a lesser degree with the Department of Revenue to identify the employers is something that we can accomplish. We already exchange data with lots of entities, including the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Revenue. We are looking at needing to get some sort of system in place to track these cases. And what we're looking at is to make it as simple as possible and find some computer system that is already out there that does a kind of basic case management system. And basically just integrate that into our system. When we looked at that, there is some cost. Our very rough estimate, and I'll give the disclaimer that these are all exceedingly rough estimates because the amendment language hasn't been drafted yet, but we wanted to give a sense of scale at least. For the IT component, we're looking at approximately $470,000 to get an off-the-shelf product and modify it to meet this program and into our system. Up front, we'd be looking at the rest of the startup costs. We think that it would probably be about 2.25 FTE to get the program implemented, and that would be education to businesses, rulemaking, getting procedures and policies in place. From there, it's really the ongoing operational piece of the program. We think if it is phased in, starting with businesses with 500 or more employees, that it's likely to take us under 2 FTE during that first initial year, and then as the number of businesses impacted expands, the resources we would need to administer would expand also. We anticipate it would probably go up to 5.25, 5.5 FTE, and again, those are very rough numbers, once the large employer is defined as a business with 50 or more employees. And that's kind of at a high level with some details about how we would do it, and I'm happy to answer any other questions about either how we would apply it or how we see it playing out.
Thank you, David. Thank you for that thorough presentation. Colleagues, any questions?
Is there going to be anybody here from OHA? Because I would like to know if an employer can even inquire of an employee if they're using public assistance. I don't even know. Maybe that's a question for somebody else, but I don't think they would be experts in that.
David, do you want to respond to that?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Thatcher, I am not an expert in that, so I don't know if employers are permitted to ask that. When we were looking at how this would play out, we were anticipating that if we were assessing a penalty against an employer, that they have due process rights to know why we think they owe the penalty, so that we would need to get some information from Oregon Health Authority, including which employees were receiving medical assistance. So we think that it's likely that we would need to provide that information to them if they challenge the penalty that we assess.
Okay, but that would be reactive, not proactive. I'm just wondering if up front an employer would be able to find out. So maybe if somebody out there listening knows the answer to that question, I would really like to know.
Okay, we'll try to find an answer to that. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Knoop.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough. Graham, do you know of any other states that have moved in this direction with legislation that's similar to this and have already implemented it, and what the result has been?
Yeah, that's a good question. Chair Denbrough, Senator Knoop, it's my understanding that states on the I know states to the north and south of us have introduced similar legislation. Of course, it's a state-specific approach. It's not my understanding that other states have not taken the exact same approach and implemented it. I do know that the state to the north has legislatively required state agencies to report out on the types of employers that actually have workers on medical assistance, and that report is, I think, an annually required. I can get you more information about that. But I do understand that that there are legislative actions afoot on this type of legislation to address this really new problem that we're facing in the post-ACA world, and I think each state goes about it a bit differently. But I'd be happy to provide any information that I can find.
Okay. David, did you have something to add?
Thank you, Chair Dembrough. I just wanted to add, again, appreciate working with your office and with the proponents of the bill and look forward to continuing to do that. The one issue that we'll also continue working on is how we can implement this while preserving the collaborative relationship that our agency relies on to work with businesses from our research and business and employment services side. That's something that we have is on our radar that we want to make sure if we're out there in a general enforcement role that it isn't impeding our ability to collaborate with businesses and business community.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Okay, I'll call up Jail Wilson and Marianne Nash and Betsy Earls. Thank you, all three of you. Thank you for your patience and waiting till today. We do have a full agenda, so if you could keep them brief, that would be great. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the Oregon State Chamber of Commerce. And this is not just an academic issue to me and the association, because I'm also an employer, and I'm not a large employer under the auspices of the bill, but I'm close, and I probably want to get there, but I'll probably reconsider. The issue with Senate Bill 845 is that you're hitching business to a health care law that is exploding costs and is becoming untenable. And I can tell you, as somebody who just re-upped my health insurance premiums, I could not find a renewal for anything less than 21% increase over previous year, which was also an increase over previous year, and so on and so forth. So the rate shock is just starting to set in. And I think that you're going to have to wrestle with that, because employers are going to have to make changes because it's $565 a month to insure a single employee. It's $1,200-plus a month to insure a family, and it's just getting to be unmanageable. And so I want that to be part of the context in which this issue is considered. There's another component of the bill. I think you should probably expect that there's going to be compression in wages as a result of this bill, because at some point there are going to have to be wage concessions in order to get to account for the health care benefits that have to be paid for. And I don't think that that's a desirable outcome either. And I think the wage compression is going to be sort of an intractable problem, because as the health care premiums continue to increase, it sucks up available resources to increase wages. And so I'd like to see the committee let this play out a little bit, because the reality is the cost of health care, even in the post-ACA world, is becoming untenable, and that is the issue. I think that we would be in a much better place to ensure our employees and keep them off the public programs if in fact the health insurance was something that was within reach. I also would ask that the committee not view this issue in isolation. I mean, there are cost pressures coming from everywhere, from my company and the thousands of others that are across the state, with regard to workers' comp costs, with regard to what's being contemplated on energy costs. We've debated a paid sick leave program. We've talked about minimum wage. I mean, the cost pressures are just really, really abundant. And I would I hope that this issue isn't taken in isolation, because as a business owner, I'm looking at this in the context of all the other things that are being talked about, and it looks pretty fearsome from where I sit. So thank you, Chair Dembrough.
Thank you, Jail.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and appearing before you in opposition to Senate Bill 845. We're opposed to Senate Bill 845 because it imposes really significant new penalties, liabilities, and reporting requirements on employers of all types as long as they're 50 or more employees. And let's just talk about the penalties for a minute. The bill requires employers with 50 or more workers to pay a penalty that's equal to 90% of the cost of an individual silver plan, which is sort of a mid-level plan on the health insurance exchange, for each worker who is getting their health coverage through health exchange or Medicaid. And although the stated purpose of the bill, as you just heard, is to reimburse the state for the money it spends on providing health insurance for workers that are not covered by their employers, the penalties the bill imposes really don't bear much relationship at all to either the state's actual cost, if any, for insurance, or to the locations and providers that an employer's workers are likely to seek care. The fact is that 90% of the cost of an individual silver plan, which is the penalty, is far more than the state would ever pay to cover an individual on Medicaid. Most of the people who would be covered employees under this bill are part of or qualify for the Medicaid expansion population that you've probably heard about in the last couple of years. And that's the group that is covered up to 138% of the, if their income is up to 138% of the poverty level. The state pays absolutely nothing for this coverage right now and will pay no more than 10% of the cost in the next several years. Even if we're talking about workers, and they'll probably be part-time workers that you're asking employers to insure here, that make a low enough income to qualify them for the Oregon Health Plan, the state covers no more than 40% of the cost of that insurance. So the significant profit that the state would realize from these penalties really would end up being dedicated to expenditures that are otherwise outlined in the bill that really don't bear much relationship at all to the cost the system incurs to insure them. One of those is increased reimbursement to healthcare providers located in health profession shortage areas. Certainly a worthy goal, but we don't have any tie between a particular employer and the employees that they employ and whether those employees would be actually treated by in a health profession shortage area. New supplemental Medicaid medical assistance programs. Again, there's no particular relationship between those medical assistance programs and the workers insured. Pay for safety net providers, and then sort of an undefined thing at the end, investing in medical residency programs. I don't think we have any argument that that's a worthy goal, but it's a little bit vague in this bill and doesn't seem appropriate for the kind of costs that you're imposing on workers. We also have particular concerns that the bill creates a new unlawful employment practice and therefore virtually a new protected class. And the notification requirements that the bill imposes on employers, including the requirement that an employer advise their employees of the availability of this particular medical assistance type program that you're seeking to cause the employer to keep their employee off of, and the fact that they can sue the employer seem a little bit extreme to us. That's my testimony.
Thank you very much, Betsy. Marianne.
Thank you. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash. I am the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau, here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 845. We echo Ms. Earle's comments in their entirety, and I will not repeat them as fun as that would be. But wanted to add a few more comments, more particular to the agricultural sector. There's a number of issues that are unique to agriculture that the bill just doesn't really respond to or answer, or the bill is very impractical in relation to those issues. One of them is, as we understand it, the bill kicks in immediately and that the health care payment requirement kicks in immediately. That's not consistent with the Affordable Care Act. And for us, as I will talk more about in a minute, in agriculture, that time of start for these types of programs is really important. So agricultural operations, for many agricultural operations, particularly in the Valley, they normally employ a very small number of workers year-round. These are small family businesses, sometimes with even one or two employees that are full-time during the year, sometimes with none that are full-time during the year. However, during particular seasons, harvest season being a large one, sometimes they will contract for a more significant number of employees, a number of workers to complete those tasks. And we have really big concerns about this bill for those types of situations, the seasonal labor situations, where these farmers normally would not hit the threshold but will hire seasonal labor that will put them over the threshold and will incur penalties, you know, when they only employ somebody for a week, a month, a few months. We also have a concern about the definition of covered employee, including a leased employee. I don't know what a leased employee is. And in the context of agriculture, that could be a significant definition for us. So there's just a lot of concerns kind of particular to the agricultural sector that we would really encourage the committee to dig into and figure out how to address, because we're hopeful that this isn't intended to, you know, bring in those businesses that employ maybe one or two folks year-round, but we'll have a seasonal workforce. So with yes. that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Marianne. So I'll just say to the three of you that some of your concerns are addressed in the Dash 1 amendments, but not all. And so this will be an ongoing debate. Colleagues, any questions? Yes.
Well, just a comment, and I think JL hit on it a little bit. It's going to apply to employers who make adjustments in their business approach, I guess, to figure out how to juggle all the costs, the increased cost pressures. Some of the businesses that are butting up against that 50 threshold right now because of ACA are deciding to maybe not hire. Are they also going to be, I mean, that's an action they're taking that is in response. So is that also going to be punishable?
I don't believe that there's any punishment contemplated for reducing your overall employment. Okay, thank you, all three.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, could I just point out also sure. that Jan Meekums of NFIB submitted written testimony, and I'm sure you have it on a list.
Great, thank
Thanks.
You. We have one last panel, Will Music and Carl Harbaugh. Oh, and Sarah Basler. Okay. Kate Newhall. Where'd they all come from?
Can we get a fourth chair?
Yeah, can we get it? Sorry. Will, why don't you start?
Good afternoon, Chair Denbrough and members of the Senate Committee on Workforce. My name is Will Music. I've been an employee of Fred Meyer's for about 9 years now. During this time, I've had a daughter, gotten married, and just recently had a son who is now 7 months old. For many years, I've also been the main provider for my family. Because I've worked for so long, I have access to health, dental, and vision insurance for my family. A few years ago, I negotiated with my work to bump up my hours designation from a part-time 12 to a part-time 20. I did this to ensure that I would always have access to health care for my family and soon-to-be newborn son. Even though I'm not technically a full-time employee, I used to consistently work about 32 hours a week, mostly due to the seniority guaranteed to me by my union. For many years, these consistent hours allowed me access to a comfortable lifestyle and maintain the benefits I had earned through my years of service. Just recently, I took a leave of absence to spend some bonding time with my son. During that time, a new scheduling system was implemented. Several new employees were hired, and returning from my leave, my hours looked drastically different. As a result of the new scheduling system and new employees the company hired, everyone's hours had been reduced. I am now struggling to maintain 20 hours a week, the minimum needed to keep my insurance. I have had my insurance temporarily revoked twice now because I haven't been able to meet the minimum threshold to meet the standard just in the last 7 months. After making a difficult decision, we decided for my wife to go to work full-time while I stayed home to take care of the kids and work part-time to try and at least keep my health benefits. After making new arrangements with my work on when my new available hours would be, I realized that they were only scheduling me about 14 to 16 hours a week. This is less than what I needed to keep the health benefits for my family, most importantly, my newborn son. When I asked my bosses why this was, they informed me that they didn't have the hours available to give me that fit with my new available hours, even though there were other employees that were working the same hours I wanted to work. Because of these reduced hours, my family is now on WIC and SNAP, something we were able to avoid for years before they implemented this new scheduling system. I'm a proud man. I was raised with very traditional values. I've worked consistently since I was 15. I'm 30 years old now. It's half of my life. I've worked hard so my wife could raise our children. I don't want to accept these state handouts. I want to provide for my family. However, my company isn't scheduling me the hours I need to do that and keep the benefits I think I've worked after working there for almost a decade. I don't want the state helping me to support my family. I need the company that I've worked for almost a decade for, the one individual store that makes over $1 billion in a year to just allow me to do what I want to do, earn a living. I strongly encourage this committee to support SB 845 and send a message that taxpayers shouldn't be forced to pick up the tab for the workers' health care when an employer refuses to provide it. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Will. Mr. Harbaugh.
Yeah, my name is Carl Harbaugh. I'm a business here in Salem. I'm nearing that 50 threshold to have 50 employees and going into this bracket, and this is another fear factor for me. I've had many years in the business, been in business for 36 years, started my own business and worked my way up, and it's a threshold that it scares me, and I think it's very detrimental to us to have all these rules and regulations based on the 50 employees, and it just I know there's much more of us than myself that are scared and don't want to go there, or they split their businesses or do whatever. And the time and the place for this is not good. I mean, the place of Oregon is a tough place to do business, and the time is the economy. We've just come back. I'm a subcontractor in the construction industry, and we're vulnerable. Our margins are down, and a lot of our work is government work, schools and improvements in infrastructure and things. And so if it falls a little bit, there's a lot of us that are right on the edge of just making it, getting by. And all this cascades down to a percentage of cost to us, to our materials and our everyone that buys groceries at Fred Meyer's is going to pay a little bit more. It's just too much for. And I just heard the testimony about the expense of this and the implementation and the government that has to handle it and control it and implement it. It's just another arm that just scares me.
Thank you very much for coming.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Basler. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association to testify in support of Senate Bill 845. The Oregon Nurses Association is Oregon's oldest and largest nursing union and professional association, and we're proud to represent over 13,000 nurses, nurse practitioners, and nursing students around the state. Our policy focus has included working on measures that increase access to quality health care, and we see Senate Bill 845 as a really important component of that. As you've heard, this bill addresses the problem of larger employers trying to avoid the Affordable Care Act coverage mandates by reducing hours and cutting benefits. You've already heard about a number of different perspectives on the cost element of this, including the increased cost to the state and to taxpayers as workers become eligible for and more heavily rely on medical assistance. But what I really wanted to focus on very briefly is the impact that change in coverage can have on workers who are, in this case, patients. You have written testimony from Sherry Malmstrom, who's a nurse leader within the Oregon Nurses Association. She very appropriately points to an example of the impact that losing coverage can have on pregnant women. That's a time during a person's life when they need to have consistent medical care. A disruption in insurance coverage can mean that they're no longer able to see the provider that they've been seeing. That may mean they have a wait time to get in to see somebody new. It's a similar situation for someone who may have a chronic health condition that requires ongoing management. So it's for these reasons that ONA is supportive of this legislation, and we ask the committee to support it as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you all very much for coming forth. We have one last person, and that's Kate Newhall.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. I think I can be quick because most of my testimony has been said before me, but I'm here today representing Family Forward, offering testimony in support of Senate Bill 845. We see this as a simple accountability measure that ensures large employers are held to the standards that are set in the Affordable Care Act rather than manipulating their employees' hours just to avoid a penalty. We believe that large employers who have workers who are on medical assistance programs because of low wages should also shoulder some of the costs that they are currently shifting to taxpayers. We think Senate Bill 845 resolves both problems with a very innovative solution. The practice of reducing hours to avoid ACA penalty really does hurt low-income workers in several ways. Most obvious, they and their family can lose their health care. But in addition, low-wage workers depend on full-time hours, or at least a dependable number of hours, to make ends meet and pay their bills on time. An arbitrary reduction in their hours can mean a reduction in their wages, which sometimes they just simply can't afford. This can be particularly problematic for women and for the families who depend on them. Women make up 64% of the part-time workers in Oregon, and women make up 60% of minimum wage workers in Oregon. By creating a penalty for large employers with workers on medical assistance programs, Senate Bill 845 will ensure that more employers are providing health care benefits to their workers, as is required. It will also help our state recover the costs of medical assistance programs if these employers don't provide health insurance. Another few fun facts for you. Women make up 54% of the Oregon Health Plan participants, and 41% of all participants are children under 18 years old. We don't believe that the taxpayer should shoulder the entire burden for employers who deny women and children access to much-needed health care. Family Forward urges your support of Senate Bill 845. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kate. Any questions for Ms. Newhall? Okay, thank you. All right, colleagues, I'm going to close this public hearing on Senate Bill 845. And I'm going to open a concurrent public hearing on Senate Bill 674 and Senate Bill 725. And Matt, could you tell us about these?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 674 appropriates money to the Department of Education for the purpose of awarding grants under the Career and Technical Education Revitalization Grant Program, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2015. Senate Bill 725 appropriates money from the general fund to the Department of Education for the purpose of awarding grants under the Career and Technical Education Revitalization Grant Program, and appropriates money from general fund to Higher Education Coordinating Commission for depositing Community College Support Fund for purpose of supporting Community College Career and Technical Education programs. The measure declares an emergency is effective July 1st, 2015.
Okay, thank you, Matt. So, colleagues, back in February, we had a CTE day. We had a youth employment day. And during those 2 days, particularly on the CTE day, we heard about, a number of really excellent programs that have been happening around the state thanks to the CTE Revitalization Fund. This was a fund that was designed back in the 2010 era as a result of a task force that I was on together with Senator Rosenbaum and a number of other people that decided that we needed to reinvest in career technical education. And we decided that the way to do that would be to develop a grant program which would also have a component of partnership with local community colleges, business, industry, and regional workforce. That first year in 2011, despite the difficulty of the recession, we were able to find a couple million dollars to put into that fund. That grew in 2013, and it needs to continue growing because it is a real hotbed of innovation in the effort to create partnerships and to bring CTE back. As you probably noticed, I am actually speaking to the bill, to Senate Bill 674, even though I haven't left my spot. But I would actually encourage Senator Rosenbaum to do the same.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I very much echo your comments and just add a little to them. I think we have great support for the programs that we have already been able to scrape together funds for. That includes more than 200 schools that have secured funding for career technical education, science, technology, engineering, and math or STEM learning since 2011. In total, we've directed nearly $14 million to CTE programs for our high school and middle schools during 2011, 13, and 14 legislative sessions. In my district, there is a model program at a school, Sabin Schellenberg, which if everyone could see that program and the just complete diversity of everything from food services, healthcare occupations, the traditional, automobile repair, But architecture, students are designing buildings, you know, doing blueprints, things that are going to lead to real careers. And these kids are so excited and so engaged that it's hard not to want that for every kid in Oregon, or at least the opportunity to take part in such a program. So I think, you know, if you look at the sponsors that we have collected on one of the bills that I think you opened the hearing on, it includes, I believe, almost every legislator in our state. So I'm proud to join you, Mr. Chair, looking back to the days when we had this initial task force to look at what we could do, to what we now have, looking ahead to what this can become for our kids and for our employers, too, who really need to have young people that are excited about the world of work, that are motivated to stay in school, and to get into these programs where they learn skills and get the kind of education that will enable them to stay in Oregon, get good jobs. And it's hard to say enough good things about this program, so I'm excited to join you.
Thank you, Senator. And just to add to that, I'll cite another statistic you've heard me say before. Kids who are in CTE programs graduate at a much higher rate. And in Portland Public Schools, which is one of my districts, kids in CTE are graduating at a 92% rate, which is much, much higher than the general population. And I think that that same statistic holds statewide and even nationwide. I will also add that in addition to these grants, we are also trying to find a stable funding source this year to so that it's not just funding isolated projects, but it's actually also providing districts with ongoing funding that they can count on that's dedicated to CTE. Now, where's Senator Olson? Oh, yeah, come on up. So our good friend from Camby also has a strong interest in CTE, and to that end he submitted Senate Bill 725. So welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alan Olson. I'm a senator from Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. And Senator Dembro, Senator Rosenbaum, I rest my case. You've sold my bill for me. Thank you very much. The school you mentioned, I'd been to many times, Sabin-Schellenberg, to watch the kids in there do construction as I do, to build walls, to do electrical work. I see those as future general contractors, and I see that as a career for them. It's my career. CTE, I have passed out some information for you from Oregon itself. Says that CTE, career technical education, is learning that works for Oregon. CTE is helping our nation meet the very real and immediate challenges of economic development, student achievement, and global competitiveness. CTE is developing our most valuable resource, our people, helping them gain the skills, technical knowledge, academic foundation, and real-world experience they need to prepare for high-skill, high-demand, high-wage careers, and keep America working in every sense of the word. That's CTE. Not everyone needs to go to college, but if they have the opportunity to, I wish they would. That being said, to come out of school, to come out of high school, to come out of community college with a career in hand, with valuable knowledge, valuable information that they have learned in school, provides them with a stepping stone that you can't get anywhere else unless you work on the job. On the job training takes quite a while, but you can still learn your profession. CTE provides that career technical expertise that they need to start today when they graduate to become very successful, to provide jobs, to provide employment to people that pay well. And that's what we need in this state. We need high-paying jobs. We need a lot of them. This provides us with the workforce that when companies come in and say, I need this type of skill, these people have that skill. They can go right to work without training and provide incentives to their company to show that I can do what you need me to do today, not tomorrow, not a year from now, but today. This is, to me, is an important bill. I support any opportunity to give children the chance to step forward and to make a better career for themselves and their families. I realize that this is a little bit of money that we're asking for, just a tad. It's going to be probably pretty hard to find. But I think for our children, this is something we need to do. We need to find this money. We need to put this forward so that our children and their children can advance in the future and bring Oregon back to the bountiful state that it always has been. Thank you, and I'll take any questions. And don't ask me that STEM question.
Yes. Oh, yeah, Vice Chair STEM question here. No, just kidding. No, you mentioned a number of, well, both you and Senator Rosenbaum mentioned a number of, I guess, career training opportunities that these high school students have. And it seems like there is a lot of crossover between STEM and some of these CTE programs. So I'm wondering if, do they cross over the grants? Are they going to be focusing on anything in particular, or is it just going to be sort of a school district by school district sort of thing, or what do you envision?
Well, I'll refer that question to Senator Deborah.
Yeah, the connection between CTE and STEM is very tight, and later on in the hearing we'll talk about one of the bills that confirms that. That connection. But in the last cycle of STEM grants, we stipulated that I think $1 million of the grants needed to go to CTE programs with a particular focus on STEM. And as it turned out, I think virtually all of the grants included some kind of STEM component. You know, it turned out that that was a very arbitrary distinction. Yeah. I mean, think of your robotics team, where you know you have people who are doing the hardware, who are doing the software. You know, they're all part of the same team.
And remember, mathematics is the ground zero for everything.
True.
Everyone needs to know mathematics, and you can't figure out the dimensions of something if you don't understand mathematics. So there's an interconnection that's critical. The other thing is too is that if you can keep a child interested, whether it be science, technology, or in the building construction trade, if you can keep them interested, they will continue their education and they will advance and they will be productive citizens, and that's what we need to do.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you for bringing this. Thanks for your passion, and thanks for putting an emergency clause on it.
Oh,
did I do that?
Senator Olson is on an emergency clause tear this week. Everywhere I go, Senator Olson has an emergency clause.
Okay, we have a panel of people who want to speak to this as well. Brian Krieg, John Rakowitz, Paloma Sparks, Joel Fisher. Can you please come up? And I know that you're going to be able to do this in just a minute each. I know it.
Yes.
Brother Rakowitz.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee, John Rakowitz with AGC. But I'm here as well, part of many, many coalitions supporting CTE STEM, connecting education to careers. We just got our buttons today. I'll be available after the hearing for anybody who'd like one. And we're distributing this for the remainder of this session to underscore our very strong support for, in particular, Senate Bill 674. That's the grants program for CTE that the chair spoke to just a couple of minutes ago. The important thing is CTE costs more money, and that's why you have to have these kind of grant startup type funds. The facilities, the equipment that you need to make this real world and really get them a path to an actual career, that's one of the reasons that you really have to have this available. Brian will speak to how oversubscribed particularly we are. We have way more interest than we have money. So we're going to be pushing for as much money in grant funds as it relates to Senate Bill 674, and as the chair spoke, we are also looking at permanent funds as well. I just want to underscore one thing about this. We are losing the race. The state of Washington puts $380 million a year into these programs. Their kids are going to be at the front of the line to get the good jobs, and we need to play catch up here in as as strongly as we can. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and turn it over to my good friend, Brian.
Thank you, John.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I do want everybody to note on the record that I'm his good friend. There are days when that we, you know, may have the differences of opinions.
CTE brings us all together.
Exactly. This is something that is important. It's highly important for our construction industry, but it's important for so many others out there.
Brian, can you give your name?
For the record, Brian Krieg, and representing IBEW and sheet metal workers and UA 290 today. As John noted, Washington is spending significantly more, $384 million during each of their bienniums on here. Currently, in the last biennium, you spent a little over $11 million on CTE for the grant program, and that was actually in two chunks, about 9.3 in the main session, and then you added another $2 million to it in the short session. Currently, what is going on in the building? In the current service levels in the Department of Education's budget, there is $9.3 million for CTE. That's a little less than the overall amount. That is in their budget. We looked at what was needed for CTE to kind of move us to the next level in Oregon. We know we can't get to $384 million right away. So taking that in some steps and working with a lot of different groups and organizations over the last year, we came up with a battle plan that comes out to about $36 million. One of the key elements of that is, yes, continue the grant programs. But the grant programs are for revitalization, one time. Buy some of the equipment, fix the shop, maybe get some of the teachers out and get them to some specific extra schooling that they need. But that needed to be something that afterwards the school districts would sustain. One of our problems, though, is what we hear from the districts, from the administrators, is we need that sustainable funding that is formula-driven for them, that is working on the seats that are involved with CTE as we expand it and bring it back out there. To do that, we talked about weighted funding formulas of one type or another. But the opportunity, I think, that has come up now is within Senate Bill 129, the one that deals with gain share. There is a section in that dedicating in the next biennium $14.25 million for that type of backbone, and having the long sunset on that bill would provide an opportunity for the schools to really rebuild their programs with confidence, and I think that that's a very important thing. That still leaves us about $11 million short of the types of projects that we would like to see done, and those include summer programs out there. They can include some regional centers and some skill centers and bringing some of the higher-level kids from high schools back in for some intensive training at certain facilities, because we don't have those types of facilities everywhere in the state. So that is kind of in a nutshell what we're looking for. Really urge you to pass the measure down to the Ways and Means Committee so that we may have another vehicle then to have the discussion and add more of the funding to this, and hopefully that will occur.
Thanks, Brian. Bloom.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The Bureau has been very supportive of the Career and Technical Education Revitalization Grant Program. This bill would continue the investment that began in 2011. As was mentioned earlier, over 200 programs have been restored, and the program has been a great success. Demand is 3-to-1 every time requests for proposals go out. The programs are across the state. Eastern Oregon has done quite well. South Coast has done well. Portland metro area has also. So it really reaches across the state, and the programs vary. They are culinary programs, construction programs, computer-aided design, boat building, welding. They run the gamut, and kids are getting an opportunity to get some hands-on training to really learn the skills that the employers of today need and the employers of the future. Part of the grant criteria is that a school must show how their program will meet the needs of employers in their community. It's a really key element. It also, an element is talking about how underserved students will gain access to these programs. So we urge your support of Senate Bill 674. We think it'll make a huge difference in expanding our investment in career and technical education.
Thanks, Paloma. Your boss has been a real champion on this from way back, and we thank him. Actually, the two gentlemen to your left have been long-term champions. The man to your right is a short-term champion. But what a future he has.
Senator Dembrough, members of the committee, I beg to differ. I'll get into that in just a little bit.
Yeah, that's true.
For the record, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of Oregon Business Association. We're a statewide organization with members, over 250 members, big and small, all across Oregon. There are I haven't totally counted, but 80-plus members of the legislature signed on to this bill. I'd like to start by reading all of their names. just kidding. I'm not going to do that. in all seriousness, we spent the summer with Business Oregon, the state's economic development agency, and the Oregon Business Council, touring the entire state, talking to local business leaders, local economic development people, local educators about what are the things that really need to be done in not only the urban but the rural parts of Oregon to create economic development. And for sure, workforce and CTE related skills were the number one issue out of everything that we heard. And so we need to be making those investments here. You've heard that Washington is beating us to it. The state's economic development focus is going to be growing our own businesses, you know, not putting an emphasis on going out and recruiting the new Nike, but growing that new Nike or Intel here. And to go with that, we need to be growing that workforce, and CTE and STEM is the way to be doing that. I myself am a graduate from Benson Polytechnic High School in Portland, so I'm a longtime champion of career technical education. And it just so happens that, in fact, as we speak at this very moment, my little brother is getting his contractor's license. Right, he drove down to Salem to do that today. Also a graduate of Benson High School, using the skills that he learned at Benson every day, self-employed as a contractor. So we urge your support for this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, all four of you. Any questions? Okay, thank you. All right, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 674 and 725. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 674. Vice Chair Thatcher.
Chair Dembrough will move Senate Bill 674 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 674 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion, colleagues, of the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Okay, the motion passes. Okay, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 674. We have a couple of other work sessions, but I think I'll hold off till the good senator returns. So why don't we move to Senate Bill 112. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 112. And colleagues, my primary purpose in opening this, and actually, Matt, why don't you tell us what it is first?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 112 establishes the Career and Technical Education Investment Council, outlines the purpose of the council, and directs the council to coordinate efforts with the STEM Investment Council. The measure details the council's membership, requires annual reporting, and requires the council to evaluate grant applications and make recommendations.
Thank you, Matt. So, colleagues, when we heard this bill, Senate Bill 112, we heard a lot of interest in turning what was originally envisioned as a CTE council into a CTE STEM council, and we're working on amendments to make that possible. In the meantime, as perhaps you know, the world of education organization, our structure, is in a bit of flux right now. And meeting with some of the primary stakeholders, we decided that it would be better for us not to pass this bill this session until we had some more certainty about just how this council would fit into the larger organization. This would allow us to put together a committee work group during the interim to track what was happening with the larger changes and to make sure that this fit in, as well as making sure that it dealt effectively with the grant writing process, the grant issuing the grants, reading the grants, et cetera. So we would stay under the current regime for this year in terms of the grants that come under the STEM Council, that come under the CTE Grant Advisory Committee. Having said that, there is no less, I think, interest in having this joint council, and interest is too weak, passion, I think. So I'd like to just quickly call up a few people just to speak to that. Brian, if you could come back up. Varner, are you here? Varner Seaman. Mark, why don't you come up as well, if you would? Thanks. Brian, please.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Krieg, here representing the sheet metal contractors and the plumbing mechanical contractors. And to note under the record, I do serve as the co-chair of the CTE Grant Advisory Committee, though I'm not really in the official capacity of that today. Senator Dembrough, I think, summed it up really well. We started with one model. We were going to build a CTE council to give a little bit more policy clout for trying to knit our various workforce and education policies together, based on the fact we saw what was going on with the STEM Council and that they were making some progress in those areas. And kind of thought was, is at some point in time, we'd probably want to maybe see about putting the two together. A lot of people started talking about this and thought, well, maybe we can try and do it now. Well, now's not really, probably not quite the right moment. We've found that there's, you know, a lot of structural things that we'll need to work on behind the scenes to make that occur. And so taking a little bit more time in the interim to do that via work group process makes a lot of sense on that. So I think for all the colleagues that I have over on the CTE advisory grant program type side, we're happy to look forward to doing this. So.
Thank you. Varner, you want to speak? You know, this is going to be a huge undertaking, so we need a lot of juice. So PGE is here to provide it.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, here on behalf of Portland General Electric. Generally, and I think particularly here on behalf of our Chief Executive Officer, Jim Pyro. Jim has a significant amount of energy and passion for this work. He currently serves as the chair of the STEM Investment Council and the co-chair of the CTE STEM Employer Coalition. As someone who is a graduate of Benson High School and moved up in his career, starting off as an engineer, as a probably excessively proud Oregon State alum, Jim Pyro is pretty committed to this work. It's also for PGE a particularly important issue for us. As we look at our workforce, 54% of our skilled workforce is eligible for retirement in the next 5 years. We want to have Oregonians move into these jobs. These are high-wage, benefited jobs. We have, and Brian represents Local 125, which represents our skilled trades folks working at Portland General Electric. And so with the letter that I passed out to the committee, Mr. Pyro is indicating his strong support for this work, and he personally would like to participate in the work group and have some engagement to try to work through these issues. And we really see CTE and STEM work as a continuum. Not that those are separate efforts, but kids who start to do things with their hands, start to tinker a little bit, may want to go into a skilled trade, may go into engineering. At the very least, we know that, as you were noting earlier, Chair Dembrough, we do get much higher high school graduation rates, and we think that's pretty high priority for us as Oregonians. So with that, we've got a pledge to help engage in that work group. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Chair Jim.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Lewis. I'm the Director of Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics for the Chief Education Office. And I also have the honor of staffing the STEM Investment Council and the work that they are doing, working very closely with Chair Pyro, as well as the opportunity to work very closely with the folks at the Department of Education, Laura Roach and others who are leading this career and technical education efforts. As has been said before, there's an awful lot of integration and overlap between career and technical education and STEM. Not only do we share very similar outcomes and philosophies around hands-on, minds-on approaches, around economic prosperity for the state, around greater student engagement, greater student graduation rates, connecting to careers, but we also recognize that we both camps have probably suffered from perception problems that we're attempting to overcome, and we're currently trying to really convey to the public at large and to our educators that industry and business has made it very clear that there is a continuum of skills that are necessary, that it's not all about four-year degrees or greater. It's not just about filling jobs, but it's also about creating jobs, and there's tremendous synergies between these two efforts. And yet there's also structural challenges that we face as well. And so what we'd like to do, including federal dollars as well as the state dollars, and how do we integrate those most sensibly. So we're looking forward to participating very closely in a work group and making sure that we're doing this right.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mark. Any questions for the panel? Okay, thank you all very much. And colleagues, any of you who want to be involved in this process in any way, please let me know. So with that, I'm going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 112. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 885. Do we have a sign-up sheet for this, Karen? Okay, so Senate Bill 885 is another CTE-related bill. It looks to using timber revenues in Lane County to help fund local CTE and youth employment programs there. And I am going to call up Jay Bozievich, Christina Payne, and Jennifer Adams. Christina, you gonna lead on this? Or? Okay, great. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you. Chair Dembro and members of the committee, my name is Jay Bozievich. I am the chair of the Lane County Board of Commissioners, and I will be speaking on behalf of the board, as this was a pre-session priority bill for the Board of Commissioners. And I'm also speaking on behalf of the 354,000 citizens of Lane County that we represent. And I just want to note real quick that before I was elected to be a commissioner, I spent 29 years as a civil engineer. So career and technical education is also important to me, as I had to try and hire people with those skills as an engineering manager, and sometimes they were quite hard to find. Lane County, for this bill, I want to point out a couple things. I have submitted written testimony in OLIS, so I'm not going to repeat that, so I just want to hit a couple bullet points. This is only a pilot project that we're proposing, and it requires a report back to the legislature in 2 years about the pilot, so it sunsets The focus is going to be on rural schools, although it'll be available through the entire county. And I think that ties to the source of funding that we're proposing, which is out of the forest funds that generate out of the U.S., the federal forests, which are predominantly out in our rural areas. So it's our rural areas that really need the help. And the county school fund dollars comes from that 25% of the U.S. Forest Service generated money, and currently that's considered local revenue. So earlier this week on Monday, when you guys passed your K-12 bill, it did not include these funds. That was outside. These funds would be above and beyond that. It limits it to the first $500,000 of revenue that Lane County generates from federal forests. So it's not all of that, which looks like there's going to still be about another $1.5 million that will go into the Common School Fund from federal forest revenue above and beyond that. And I think what this does is it really adds to the conversation you all have been having this afternoon about how best to use those CTE funds. And I think Christina and Jennifer, sorry, I was going to say something else, but thank you. We'll add to that conversation about how we're going to tie this in. But right now, a lot of this is administered through the ESDs and done through grants through the schools. This is going to hopefully tie it more to be employer-centric in some ways, and tying the employers to the students in a much more focused way. So I think it's going to add to that conversation in general about how best to use this. So I'd just like to end by saying that the county supports the Dash 1 amendments that are proposed, and we'd just like to see you move this on to a work session, and I'll turn it over to Christina.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Christina Payne. I am the executive director for Lane Workforce Partnership, which is the local workforce investment board for Lane County. And this came about through conversations that started over 9 months ago with the county in regards to the diminishing resources around career and technical education and the demonstration that we'd seen of the effectiveness of these programs, primarily in the metro area of our community. So we've seen the demonstration, and I feel like a little bit I'm preaching to the choir at this point in time of how great CTE programs are. But the emergent need is around the lack of funding. Our federal funds are out for bid right now for youth proposals, and we received over $1 million in requests from just 9 programs, schools in our area. And we estimate that we are only receiving over $600,000 of federal funding. So we won't even be able to cover the need that's come to us. This doesn't even include schools that don't even have the resources to compete for these types of funds. So schools like Siuslaw High School in Florence, Mapleton High School, Crow, Elmira, Oak Ridge, Junction City, the list goes on of small schools in small communities in one county that could be greatly served if we had additional resources to design these programs, replicate what's happening in the metro area, bring them out to those parts of our county, and have a demonstration project that we could possibly replicate in other parts of the state of Oregon. We, as a workforce board, have demonstrated a lot of success with this. With our last year's funds, with our just over 600,000, we had over 234 young people benefit from these programs. 111 gained work experience and training through internships with local employers. 53 youth demonstrated a gain in financial literacy skills. 13 participated in pre-apprenticeship programs. 64 increased their reading levels, 69 increased their math, and we had 160 youth earn their National Career Readiness Certificate as well. So with that, basically, I wanted to be able to demonstrate that we do capture data and can report back to this committee and the legislature in the next 2 years. I know we're going to see benefits from this type of program, and we can bring that information back to you. I've also brought information that we put together in partnership with the Employment Department on our county, and I'm happy to share this document as well so that you have information on our county, our economy, our businesses, and our community, and the basic needs that they have for a workforce.
Thank you very much, Christina. Ms. Adams?
Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Adams, and I'm with Bulk Handling Systems, located in Eugene, Oregon, and we are a manufacturer of recycling equipment. So our core pieces of our business is our drafting department and our welding fabricating department. That makes up about 50% plus of our employees, and these employees are very difficult to find. Right now, in our production department alone, the average age is 56 years old, and we have a very challenging time finding even experienced fabricators to come in and fill new roles as our business expands. Through our work with Lean Workforce Partnership, we were able to identify CTE programs in the local community that we could tour, learn more about, and bring students in to work on our shop floor. I had been with the business for approximately 1 year and essentially had given up on finding any CTE programs. They did not seem to exist in Lane County at this point in time. When it was brought to our attention that Springfield High School had a phenomenal program, we went and toured, and we were able to hire two high schoolers after graduation directly into our business. From there, we were able to build relationships with other high schools in the area, Thurston High School and most recently Willamette High School. But if you look at a map of CTE programs in Lane County right now, it's mostly in those metro areas, and the rural areas do not have programs available. We have jobs for these students, but they aren't gaining the skill sets they need to come and work on our shop floor. So we're excited about this bill bringing this this CTE program possibility to these rural areas so that we too can provide jobs for those students.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming up. Colleagues, any questions? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
I'm just curious, and I don't claim to understand how the school funding formula works, but maybe
we'll probably
especially when federal funds and resources, all that comes in, so maybe somebody else is going to be coming up to testify. It sounds like you get $2 million right now from the federal forest reserves, and then you're saying that this bill would divert 500 for the purposes of funding some of these CTE programs within Lane County for the rural schools. Is that what you're saying?
That's pretty accurate. If with the pending SRS legislation that is in Congress right now, it's passed the House and it's waiting for the Senate to come back into session after Easter.
And that's the secure rural schools.
Yeah. We would get approximately $2 million into our common school fund from those SRS funds, the county school fund, I should say. And then we typically then turn around and transfer that money into the state's common school fund. What this would do is divert $500,000 before we write that check into this CTE program.
And so, follow up, since that wouldn't be considered local revenue anymore, does that mean that the state, that you'd be more entitled to more from the state to offset that? And I guess that's where the funding formula confusion might come from, and perhaps somebody else can answer that.
Yeah, and I believe that's accurate.
Senator Gelsman knows.
Former Representative Gelser.
Whoever I am. So I think another way of asking the question, it's not so much that you would be entitled to more, but there would be less money going into the state school fund, so you would be allowed to take more money in for your school district than other school districts would be around the state. So for instance, if my local district put money in, that would, if we have local revenues, that counts. It counts against what comes to us from the state school fund. Anything that's excluded isn't counted inside of that. So it becomes an enhancement beyond what everybody else gets.
Is that
the question?
Yeah, that was the question.
Yeah, and I believe that's an accurate statement, that that $500,000 would be exempted from local revenue, but it would be dedicated to these CTE programs and specifically focused in the rural areas where there's really great need.
Okay, thank you all very much for coming. Okay, Lori Wimmer, come up, please.
I'm bringing a friend with your permission.
Sure.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, Brian Reeder, Assistant Superintendent in the Office of Research at the Department of Education. Just want to give you some clarification on how our funding formula works so that you'll get a clear understanding of the impact of what this bill will do. As Senator Thatcher mentioned, federal forest fees come into the state. They go to counties. 25% of that is then distributed to school districts. And those funds received by school districts are counted as local revenue in our funding formula. So, in effect, local revenues and the state school fund are combined statewide to form what we call total formula revenue, and that amount is then distributed to each school district in the state based on the number of weighted students that they have. So what this bill does is take $500,000, is my understanding, that would flow to school districts in Lane County, and instead it is retained by Lane County, Lane County government. That means that in the aggregate, school districts in Lane County will have 500,000 fewer dollars in local revenue. Most of that loss in revenue to those school districts in Lane County will be made up through our formula. 99.9 cents on the dollar, pretty much. To get those monies to make the school districts in Lane County almost whole, we have to take money away from every other school district in the state. So, in effect, the $500,000 being retained by Lane County is coming from every school district in the state, not just those in Lane County. That's how our funding formula works. So this would be a program funded by every school district in the state. My understanding it was described as a pilot program, but just want to be clear on where that money actually comes from.
Thank you, Brian. Now, that wouldn't apply if we're talking about a grant, right, that goes to a school district. That doesn't affect the formula at all. I mean, if there's federal dollars coming in, for example, or something like that.
Chair Dembro, that's correct. The money that flows through our formula is primarily the state school fund and then what we call local revenue, which is dominated by local property taxes, but also has a number of other smaller revenue sources and these federal forest fees are one of those sources that are called local revenue and flow through the formula.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing 42,000 members of the Oregon Education Association, whose names I will not read. We are longtime supporters of career technical education. We support the three bills that you've already discussed previously today. Unfortunately, my members cannot support this bill before you, Senate Bill 885, even with the -1 amendments, which reduce the impact somewhat, but still, as you've just heard, basically caused 49,000 students to benefit from, to be subsidized by 516,000 others around the state, in effect, because of the way the formula works. We were, as part of the School and Forest Coalition at NEA, authors of the Secure Rural Schools Fund, which became the Craig Wyden bill. I personally testified on Capitol Hill and worked to retain and restore those dollars over time. We care very much about that 25% that's supposed to go to schools and not to youth employment programs or other kinds of pilot projects. It's supposed to be considered local revenue for the total formula, as you've heard. Lane County gets the largest chunk of those resources from the Federal Forest Fees Program. It's the county that gets the greatest share of the resource that comes to Oregon from the federal government. And by taking these out of the formula, we in effect make those dollars invisible with respect to how the money that you've all helped us articulate is not enough in the next two-year budget for the state school fund. It makes that spread differently than it otherwise would without this bill. We consider this a precedent setter. We have had bills similar to it in the past. The Confederation of Oregon School Administrators has deputized me to say that they too oppose it, as they have partnered with us in past years in stopping similar proposals from becoming law, for the same reason, that there's a slippery slope of taking one local revenue source after another outside of the formula, which caused certain school districts to benefit at the expense of all the others. If you do move the bill, it would seem to us that it should go to revenue. I see that it doesn't have a referral to revenue, but because this is something that impacts the school funding formula, it would seem to me that ideally that would be a policy call for them as well to be weighing in on. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions if you have them.
Thank you very much, Lori. Any questions for either Mr. Reeder or Lori? Okay, thank you both for that information. Okay, colleagues, we will see what happens with this bill. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on whatever this number was, 885. And I'm going to do a couple of work sessions now, since we're all here together. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 496. Matt, remind us, this was from quite a while ago, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 496 permits certain occupational injuries or diseases to qualify for benefits from the Public Safety Memorial Fund. There is no revenue impact. There was a fiscal statement issued indeterminate, and there is no subsequent referral to another committee.
Chair Dembro, I moved Senate Bill 496 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 496 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Is there any objection to us moving this bill? Seeing none, the motion passes. Anyone like to carry this bill?
It's Senator Devlin's bill.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, is that right?
I mean, it is Senator Devlin's bill.
Since it's Senator Devlin's bill, we will ask him to carry. And if he refuses, I will conscript Senator Knope.
I'll back him up, yeah.
Thank you. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 496. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 555. Matt, remind us about this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 555 requires qualified nonprofit agencies for individuals with disabilities to pay individuals with disabilities at least the minimum wage or the prevailing wage if employed on public works projects. The measure assigns enforcement to the Department of Administrative Services and becomes operative January 1st, 2016. The measure declares an emergency is effective on passage. There is no revenue impact, but there is a fiscal impact for the -4 amendments. I should clarify that there is a -2 amendment that clarifies the effect upon existing and imminent public contracts, and there are -4 amendments which define relevant terms, remove the requirement of the Department of Administrative Services to set prices for products and services contracted with qualified nonprofit agencies, and to verify that qualified nonprofit agencies are paying workers at least minimum wage or prevailing wage, and to double check then that the fiscal impact has been issued for the -4 amendments.
Senator Gelser.
Do you want me to start with the amendments and then describe them further? All right. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments dated April 3rd, 2015.
Senator Gelser has moved to adopt the -2 amendments dated April 3rd, 2015. Is there any discussion? And Senator Gelser, perhaps you could tell us about these changes. Let me just say, I know that there's been a lot of work done on this bill with various stakeholders, and I think these amendments have accomplished a lot in alleviating concerns. Can you tell us about them?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The -2 amendments do a couple of things. I worked on this in collaboration with the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. It creates a transition period
for this. It makes it even more clear that all existing contracts are grandfathered in under their current wage rates. It would apply only to new contracts that are adopted after the effective date of the bill. It would allow contracts that are existing, but then the same contract is renewed, to also not come under that minimum wage requirement until July 1st of 2018, and that allows more time to plan for that transition. I did just receive an email from Darvin Pierce at DAS, and he said that the increased staffing costs and most of the increased legal costs that are in the fiscal will go away with the with that timeline, because it just makes it much smoother over time. And that's the dash two. I would also clarify, this impacts about 500 workers statewide. And we'll get to this in the dash four. And it's only those that are working on public contracts, and the increased cost, that is in the fiscal. It's why it's going to Ways and Means. That ensures that nobody has a job that will be at risk.
Thank you. Senator, why don't we take the opportunity to hear about the dash fours as well?
All right.
Even though they haven't been moved.
All right. So the dash four amendments, there were concerns raised. You know how when we draft bills, legislative council will go through and kind of clean up the statute to conform with form and style? There were some concerns that those form and style would change some elements of the definition of a QRF. So this restores the original language that was cleaned up in that way. It also made even more clear, if you look on page 2, lines 3 to 5, that this is not applying to every contract that that a QRF has. This is part of what we talked about and when you and I spoke about this, Senator Knope, and we changed the language to that pays individuals with disabilities who are employed to work on contracts for a local, state, or federal public agency at least the minimum wage set forth in state or federal law. So this makes it very clear it is only those public contracts.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or discussion, colleagues?
Well, sure. I think that really helps make it a much better bill. But maybe I'll get at some of my concerns when we get to the motion of the overall bill. But yeah, I think
great.
Those are good changes.
Okay. Any other discussion on the dash two amendments? Okay, seeing none. Is there any objection to us adopting these dash twos? Okay, seeing none. They are adopted. Senator Gelsinger.
Chair Dembrough, I move to adopt the dash four amendments dated April 6th, 2015.
Senator Gelsinger has moved to adopt the dash four amendments dated April 6th, 2015. Discussion? Is there any objection to us adopting these dash fours?
And Mr. Chair, yes. My office did send out to all of the stakeholders today the dash fives, which were just a blending of the dash two and the dash four.
Okay, is there any objection to us adopting the dash four amendments? Seeing none, they are adopted. Senator Gelsinger.
Chair Dembrough, I move Senate Bill 555 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Gelsinger has moved Senate Bill 555 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion of the main motion. Senator Gelsinger.
Great. So first I wanted to thank Chair Dembrough and all of you for taking the time to consider this bill. There are a lot of issues related to this bill that are not actually part of this bill, and they have been discussed at length in a variety of hearings across the building. I think a lot of that discussion is reflective of the changing expectations of and for people that experience intellectual and developmental disabilities, and I think that's a positive thing. We are at a time of significant transition around employment and how we deliver employment services in the state, and there are a lot of opinions about how fast or how slow we should move, what the right thing or the wrong thing is to do, But what I know about everyone involved in the discussion is that everybody wants to make sure that people with disabilities are able to work. And I especially want to thank the Oregon Rehabilitation Association and the members of that organization for helping to develop these amendments that make things more workable, and for not opposing the bill. That's really made my day. Again, this bill is very narrow. I wish that we could move forward more quickly and make sure that all people with disabilities have the same minimum wage protections that people without disabilities enjoy. But I understand that it's complicated and requires further discussion. This is a good first step. It's also very exciting for the movement in this discussion. I believe that when we take this vote in this committee today, we will be the first legislative entity to take a vote on minimum wage for people with disabilities in the United States. And that's a very meaningful thing. And I'm just really grateful that we have the chance to do this, and we wouldn't have without the great collaboration with the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. So my thanks to all of you. I know it's been a difficult issue, and just coming forward with that good faith and focus on the people you serve, I can't thank you enough for that.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Knoop.
Thank you, Chair Dembro. I just wanted to ask Senator Gelser a question as it relates to the most severely disabled, and I think you mentioned that it wouldn't affect really anybody's job. I just wanted to understand how you feel like that isn't going to affect the most severely disabled, because obviously those of us who have been to the sheltered workshop environment and have seen the work that's going on recognize that there are people who in a minimum wage or prevailing wage situation probably wouldn't be employed. And so could you just kind of put on the record how you think that'll work for the severely disabled?
Yes. So Senate Bill 555, as I mentioned, is very narrow, and it only applies to those QRF contracts, which are entered into with a public agency. When a public agency contracts out for goods or services, they are required first to go to a qualified rehabilitation facility. So these contracts are set aside. It's not. The state can't just decide we're not going to get ODOT vests from Shangri-La anymore. They have a right to that contract. The law also requires that when DAS sets the price for that contract, that it includes the cost of the wages. So what this bill does is, and right now among the 500 people that this would impact that are working, I believe I talked with Nan, the average wage right now is about
$5.25.
Between $5 and $6 an hour. So that's that on average. Some are earning less, some are earning more, but the reason it's going to Ways and Means is as we as the public will pick up that cost. So the nonprofit organizations that are running the QRFs will not have to go out and raise more money in order to be able to keep people doing the work that they're doing. And that's what I like about this bill. It's much narrower. We get to see how it works, how it impacts the workers, and it will inform that broader conversation about others with disabilities.
And then just a further question. The Department of Justice expressed an interest in kind of what was going on with this bill. Can anybody speak to that and what the ramifications are?
Senator Gelser probably can. We did hear from the Department of Justice concern about those changes in the language that Senator Gelser mentioned. And I think those concerns have been alleviated now that we're back to the original language.
Okay.
That went to the House the form and style changes.
Okay. Senator Thatcher.
Yeah, those were mostly my questions had to do with the Department of Justice concerns. And I wondered if that was addressed in the amendment, and I wasn't clear on that. And also the concerns about the most severely, the people most affected by it that have severe disabilities or multiple disabilities that might have difficulty finding work under this scenario. That still concerns me. So I don't know. I know I realize it's very very narrowly tailored, and I do appreciate. That, but I'm hesitant to just jump headlong into this thing.
Thank you. Okay, I just want to say in closing, you know, also to back up Senator Gelser and thanking the advocates for coming forward. I think everybody involved in this issue is really concerned about the workers here. And I think this is a bill that moves us forward, does it in a way that really looks out for the interests of the workers, and I think is a testament to good governing. So with that, Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Aye.
Senator
Rezaton?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Thatcher?
No.
Chair Dembro? Aye. Okay, the motion passes. This is headed to Ways and Means. I will close this work session on Senate Bill 555.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you. We have Senate Bill 701, and we have people who have been waiting patiently to speak. And I think maybe we just have time to open this bill and just hear about it. Representative Barnhart's here. Perhaps he could speak to us. Our good people from SAFE, would you be able to come back to? I don't want to rush through this. This is an important issue. Matt, tell us what this is. Representative Barnhart, could you come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 701 establishes a process for random selection of physicians from a list of qualified physicians maintained by the Director of Department of Consumer Business and Consumer and Business Services for medical examinations and workers' compensation claims.
Okay, Representative Barnhart, and I think Senator Byer is going to show up as well. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the State Representative for Mouse District 11. I really want to talk about the problem that this bill is intended to resolve and let Senator Byer talk about the specific issues in the bill. As most of you know, I used to practice psychology in Eugene. One of the things that I did was do psychotherapy and counseling for people who were suffering from depression and a variety of other disorders. And I had the occasion to submit bills for treatment to workers' comp for payment from the insurance companies. It was not unusual for them to hire a particular psychiatrist to do an evaluation for the purpose of demonstrating that the depression was not caused by the worker's injury but by something else. I could have predicted quite readily what that report was going to look like because, in fact, they did look very similar from all these reports. What Oregon needs for the management of the independent medical examination is a fair and impartial examination from someone who is not beholden to the insurance company for work. Currently, the insurance companies hire medical examiners to do these evaluations, and the clear import to any of us who've ever been practitioners is that the people who get the work are the ones who give the kinds of results that the insurance companies want and expect. I think it's important for the legislature to change this law to make it clear that these are actually independent and that they are actually not beholden to the insurance companies to be hired to do the work. There are several possible ways this can be done. Senator Byer's bill is one that I think will work, and that's all I would like to say about the problem. But I think this is a significant problem, and it does result in people being poorly treated in the workers' comp system and denied the benefits which they are due.
Thank you very much, Representative. Senator Byer, so what's the fix?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, Lee Byer, State Senator from District 6, which represents Central Linn and Lane counties. I think Representative Barnhart did a pretty good job of laying this out. Really, the issue from my perspective is one of I've been hearing for a number of years that people think that the system is rigged against them. on the independent reviews. This bill, Senate Bill 701, whatever the number is, does not change the ability or authority of insurance companies or an injured worker to go independent reviews. It just changes the way it has done, so you have some independence in the system. And I think, as Representative Barnhart said, I think there's a reality, but if not a reality, there at least there's a perception that if the insurance company is hiring the independent reviewer, they're going to get the result that they want. That may not be accurate, but that is a perception, and I can tell you that in the system, if you listen to people enough, and I've heard this in my years of doing this, that that's true. I frankly had a family experience with it. My brother-in-law went through this in the last year. It was an unfortunate situation and felt like he was getting run around, and his attorney was telling him, well, you're not going to get a good review out of this thing because it just doesn't work that way. I think that's wrong. When I've thought about this, the system that I looked to, frankly, was modeling after the real estate industry. And that's a business that I'm fairly familiar with, and I go back in that industry back to the savings and loan debacles in the 80s and a couple of banking changes. And through that period of time, the federal government regulating those tried to get some independence for appraisers to make sure that loans were getting made in a good way, and they've gone through evolutions of that. And where you're at now is that a lender has to reach out and have a randomly selected appraiser who's familiar with the territory doing the appraisal, so that you know that the value that's being put there is accurate. That model makes sense to me for medical examiners. As I've worked with the workers' comp division, they believe that they can do that at a relatively minor cost, not adding a lot of complexity to the system, and make it work, quite frankly. And I think it adds credibility to the system. It will assure that reviews truly are independent, and they'll come out as they're going to come out. It's just that they're independent. They're not going to be slanted one way or another. If nothing more than adding credibility to the system, I think that's important. And I go back and my work around workers' comp to 1917 when the deal was made, and the deal was very clear. Workers agreed that they would not be able to sue their employer if they were injured on the job. Employers agreed that in turn for that protection, that they would provide the injured worker with medical services if they got hurt on the job. This just follows through on that promise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Colleagues, we're not going to have time to do more with this today. Those of you who came to speak to this, I'm sorry about that. You know, we were because we went late on Monday on the floor, we were supposed to have done 8:45, and things just rolled over. So we will do that with this bill as well. We'll schedule a time, hopefully next week, to hear this bill. We'll let you know as soon as we know. Representative.
Mr. Chair, we hope that the committee will be scheduling a work session in the next little bit.
Yes, thank you, Representative, for reminding me of the deadline. it's something I keep forgetting about. Hardly. Colleagues, in OLIS, there is some testimony that's been submitted if you want to get other information about this bill. Okay, thank you. Thank you both. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 701. And before we adjourn, just remind you that Monday is our minimum wage day, and so we will be having an evening hearing on that issue jointly with the House. So with that, colleagues, we are adjourned.
Is that 6?
Monday the 13th?
6 to 8? It's like sick leave, but yeah. We schedule it for 6 to 8.
Yeah,
we schedule it for 6 to 8.